Welcome to Astounding Stories of Space and Time. I'm Mardell, reading Storm Over Warlock by Andre Norton. Chapter 2, Death of a Ship. That sigh of displaced air was not as loud as a breeze, but it echoed monstrously in Shan's ears. He could not believe his luck as that sound grew fainter, drew away into the valley he had just left. With infinite caution, he raised his head from his arm, still hardly able to accept the fact that he had not been sighted, that the Throgs and their flyer were gone. But that black plate was spinning out into the sun haze. One of the beetles might have suspected that there were Terran fugitives and ordered a routine patrol. After all, how could the aliens know that they had caught all but one of the survey party in camp? Though with all the Terran scout flitters grounded on the field, the men dead in their bunks, the surprise would seem to be complete. As Shan moved, Taggy and Togi came to life also. They had gone to Earth with speed, and the man was sure that both beasts had sensed danger. Not for the first time, he knew a burning desire for the formal education he had never had. In camp he had listened, dragging out routine jobs in order to overhear reports and the small talk of specialists keen on their own particular hobbies. But so much of the information Shan had thus picked up to store in a retentive memory, he had not understood and could not fit together. It had been as if he were trying to solve some highly important puzzle, with at least a quarter of the necessary pieces missing, or with unrelated bits from others intermixed. How much control did a trained animal scout have over his furred or feathered assistants? And was part of that mastery a mental rapport built up between man and animal? How well would the Wolverines obey him now, especially when they would not return to camp, where cages stood waiting as symbols of human authority? Wouldn't a trek into the wilderness bring about a revolt for complete freedom? If Shan could depend upon the animals, it would mean a great deal. Not only would their superior hunting ability provide all three with food, but their scouting senses, so much keener than his, might erect a slender wall between life and death. Few large native beasts had been discovered on Warlock by the Terran explorers. And of those four or five different species, none had proved hostile if unprovoked. But that did not mean that somewhere back in the wild lands into which Shan was heading, there were no heretofore unknowns. Perhaps slyer, and as vicious as the wolverines when they were roused to rage. Then there were the dreams, which had afforded the prime source of camp discussion and dispute. Shan brushed coarse sand from his boots and thought about the dreams. Did they or did they not exist? You could start an argument any time by making a definite statement for or against the peculiar sort of dreaming reported by the first scout to set ship on this world. The Circe system, of which Warlock was the second of three planets, had first been scouted 4 years ago by one of those explorers traveling solo in survey service. Everyone knew that the first N scouts were a weird breed, almost a mutation of Terran stock. Their reports were rife with strange observations. So, an alarming one concerning Circe, a yellow sun such as Sol, and her three planets was not so rare, which, the world nearest in orbit to Circe, was too hot for human occupancy, without drastic and too costly world-changing. Wizard, the third out from the sun, was mostly bare rock and highly poisonous water. But Warlock, swinging through space between two forbidding neighbors, seemed to be just what the settlement board ordered. Then the survey scout, even in the cocoon safety of his well-armed ship, began to dream, and from those dreams a horror of the apparently empty world developed until he fled the planet to preserve his sanity. There had been a second visit to Warlock in check. Worlds so well adapted to human emigration could not be lightly thrown away. And this time there was a negative report, no trace of dreams, no registration of any outside influence on the delicate and complicated equipment the ship carried. So the survey team had been dispatched to prepare for the coming of the first pioneers, and none of them had dreamed either, at least no more than the ordinary dreams all men accepted. Only there were those who pointed out that the seasons had changed between the first and second visits to Warlock. That first scout had planeted in summer. His successors had come in fall and winter. They argued that the final release of the world for settlement should not be given until a full year on Warlock had been sampled. But the pressure of immigrant control had forced their hands, that in the fear of just what had eventually happened, an attack from the Throgs. So they had speeded up the process of declaring Warlock open. Only Ragnar Thorvald had protested that decision up to the last and had gone back to headquarters on the supply ship a month ago to make a last appeal for a more careful study. Shan stopped, brushing the sand from the tough fabric above his knee. Ragnar Thorvald. He remembered back to the port landing apron on another world. Remembered with a sense of loss he could not define. That had been about the second biggest day of his short life. The biggest had come earlier, when they had actually allowed him to sign on for survey duty. He had tumbled off the cross-continent cargo carrier, his kit, a very meager kit, slung over his thin shoulder, a hot eagerness expanding inside him until he thought that he could not continue to throttle down that wild happiness. There was a waiting starship, and he, Shan Lanti from the dumps of Tyr, without any influence or schooling, was going to blast off in her, wearing the brown-green uniform of survey. Then he had hesitated, uncertainly, had not quite dared cross the few feet of apron lying between him and that compact group, wearing the same uniform, with a slight difference, that of service bars and completion badges and rank insignias. With the unconscious self-assurance of men who had done this many times before. But after a moment, that whole group had become, in his own shy appraisal, just a background for one man. Shan had never before known in his pinched and limited childhood, his lost boyhood, anyone who aroused in him hero worship. And he could not have put a name to the new emotion that added so suddenly to his burning desire to make good, not only to hold the small niche in survey, which he had already so painfully achieved, but to climb until he could stand so in such a group, talking easily to that tall man, his uncovered head bronze yellow in the sunlight, his cool gray eyes pale in his brown face. Not that any of those wild dreams born in that minute or two had been realized in the ensuing months. Probably those dreams had always been as wild as the ones reported by the first scout on Warlock. Shan grinned wryly now at the short period of childish hope and half-confidence that he could do big things. Only one Thorvald had ever noticed Shan's existence in the survey camp, and that had been Garth. Garth Thorvald, a far less impressive, one could say a smudged copy of his brother, swaggering with an arrogance Ragnar never showed. Garth was a cadet on his first mission, intent upon making Shan realize the unbridgeable gulf between a labor hand and an officer-to-be. He had appeared to know right from their first meeting just how to make Shan's life a misery. Now in this slit of valley, well away from the domes, Shan's fists balled. He pounded them against the earth in a way he had so often hoped to plant them on Garth's smoothly handsome face, his well-muscled body. One didn't survive the dumps of Tyr without learning how to use fists and boots and a list of tricks they didn't teach in any academy. He had always been sure that he could take Garth if they mixed it up. But if he had loosed the tight rein he had kept on his temper and offered that challenge, he would have lost his chance with Survey. Garth had proved himself able to talk his way out of any scrape, even minor derelictions of duty, and he far outranked Shan. The laborer from Tyr had had to swallow all that the other could dish out, and hoped that on his next assignment he would not be a member of young Thorvald's team. Though because of Garth Thorvald, Shan's toll of black record marks had mounted dangerously high, and each day the chance for any more duty tours had grown dimmer. Shan laughed, and the sound was ugly. That was one thing he didn't have to worry about any longer. There would be no other assignments for him. The Throgs had seen to that. And Garth? Well, there would never be a showdown between them now. He stood up. The Throg ship had disappeared. They could push on. He found a break in the cliff wall, which was climbable, and he coaxed the wolverines after him. When they stood on the heights from which the falls tumbled, Taggy and Togi rubbed against him, cried for his attention. They too appeared to need the reassurance they got from contact with him, for they were also fugitives on this alien world, the only representatives of their kind. Since he did not have any definite goal in view, Shan continued to be guided by the stream, following its wanderings across a plateau. The sun was warm, so he carried his jacket slung across one shoulder. Taggy and Togi raced ahead, twice catching skitterers, which they devoured voraciously. A shadow on a sun-baked rock sent the Terran skidding for cover until he saw that it was cast by one of the questing falcons from the upper peaks. But that shook his confidence, so he again sought cover, ashamed at his own carelessness. In the late afternoon, he reached the far end of the plateau, faced a climb to peaks which still bore cones of snow, now tinted a soft peach by the sun. Shan studied that possible path, and distrusted his own powers to take it without proper equipment or supplies. He must turn either north or south, though he would then have to abandon a sure water supply in the stream. Tonight he would camp where he was. He had not realized how tired he was until he found a likely half-cave in the mountain wall and crawled in. There was too much danger in fire here. He would have to do without that first comfort of his kind. Luckily, the wolverines squeezed in beside him to fill the hole. With their warm, furred bodies sandwiching him, Shan dozed, awoke and dozed again, listening to night sounds, the screams, cries, hunting calls of the warlock wilds. Now and again, one of the wolverines whined and moved uneasily. Fingers of sun picked at Shan through a shaft among the rocks, striking his eyes. He moved, blinked blearily awake, unable for the first few seconds to understand why the smooth plaster wall of his bunk had become rough red stone. Then he remembered. He was alone, and he threw himself frantically out of the cave, afraid the wolverines had wandered off. Only both animals were busy, clawing under a boulder with steady persistence, which argued there was a purpose behind that effort. A sharp sting on the back of one hand made that purpose only too clear to Shan, and he retreated hurriedly from the vicinity of the excavation. They had found an earth wasp's burrow and were hunting for grubs, naturally arousing the rightful inhabitants to bitter resentment. Shan faced the problem of his own breakfast. He had had the immunity shots given to all members of the team, and he had eaten game brought in by exploring parties and labeled safe. But how long he could keep to the varieties of native food he knew was uncertain. Sooner or later, he must experiment for himself. Already he drank the stream water without the aid of purifiers, and so far there had been no ill results from that necessary recklessness. Now the stream suggested fish, but instead he chanced upon another water inhabitant, which had crawled upon the land for some obscure purpose of its own. It was a sluggish, scaled thing, an easy victim to his club. With thin, weak legs, it could project at will from a finned and armor-plated body. Shan offered the head and guts to Togi, who had abandoned the wasp nest. She sniffed in careful investigation and then gulped. Shan built a small fire and seared the firm greenish flesh. The taste was flat, lacking salt, but the food eased his emptiness. Enheartened, he started south, hoping to find water sometime during the morning. By noon, he had his optimism justified with the discovery of a spring, and the wolverines had brought down a slender-legged animal whose coat was close in shade to the dusky purple of the vegetation. Smaller than a Terran deer, its head bore not horns, but a ridge of stiffened hair rising in a point some 12 inches about the skull dome. Shan hacked off some ragged steaks while the wolverines feasted in earnest, carefully burying the head afterward. It was when Shan knelt by the spring pool to wash that he caught the clamor of the clack-clacks. He had seen or heard nothing of the flyers since he had left the lake valley, but from the noise now rising in an ear-splitting volume, he thought there was a sizable colony nearby and that the inhabitants were thoroughly aroused. He crept on his hands and knees to a nearby brush cover, heading toward the source of that outburst. If the clacks were announcing a Throg scouting party, he wanted to know it. Lying flat, with branches forming a screen over him, the Terran gazed out on a stretch of grassland, which sloped at a fairly steep angle to the south, and which must lead to a portion of countryside well below the level he was now traversing. The clack-clacks were skimming back and forth, shrieking their staccato war cries. Following the erratic dashes of their flight formation, Shan decided that whatever they railed against was on the lower level, out of his sight from that point. Should he simply withdraw, since the disturbance was not near him? Prudence dictated that, yet still he hesitated. They had no desire to travel north or to try and scale the mountains. No, south was his best path, and he should be very sure that route was closed before he retreated. Since any additional fuss the clack-clacks might make on sighting him would be undistinguished in their now general clamor, the Terran crawled on to where tall grass provided a screen at the top of the slope. There he stopped short, his hands digging into the earth in sudden breaking action. Below, the ground steamed from a rocket flare back. grasses burned away from the fins of a small scout ship. But even as Shan rose to one knee, a shout of welcome choked in his throat. One of those fins sank, canting the ship crookedly, preventing any new takeoff, and over the crown of a low hill to the west swung the ominous black plate of a Throg flyer. The Throg ship came in a burst of speed, and Shan waited tensely for some countermove from the scout. Those small, speedy Terran ships were prudently provided with weapons triply deadly in proportion to their size. He was sure that the Terran ship could hold its own against the Throg, even eliminate the enemy. But there was no fire from the slanting pencil of the scout. The Throg circled warily, obviously expecting a trap. Twice it darted back in the direction from which it had come. As it returned from its second retreat, another of its kind showed, a black coin dot against the amber of the sky. Shan felt sick inside. Now the Terran scout had lost any advantage and, perhaps, all hope. The Throgs could box the other in, cut the downed ship to pieces with their energy beams. He wanted to crawl away and not witness this last disaster for his kind. But some stubborn core of will kept him where he was. The Throgs began to circle, while beneath them the flock of clack-clacks screamed and dived at the slanting nose of the Terran ship. Then that same slashing energy he had watched quarter the camp snapped from the far plate across the stricken scout. The man who had piloted her, if not dead already, which might account for the lack of defense, must have fallen victim to that. But the Throg was going to make very sure. The second flyer halted, remained poised long enough to unleash a second bolt, dazzling any watching eyes and broadcasting a vibration to make Shan's skin crawl. When the last faint ripple reached his outlook post. What happened then? The overconfident Throg was not prepared to take. Shan cried out, burying his face on his arm, as pinwheels of scarlet light blotted out normal sight. There was an explosion, a deafening blast. He cowered, blind, unable to hear. Then, rubbing at his eyes, he tried to see what had happened. Through watery blurs, he made out the Throg ship, not swinging now in serene indifference to Warlock's gravity, but whirling end over end across the sky, as might a leaf tossed in a gust of wind. Its rim caught against a rust-red cliff. It rebounded and crumpled. Then it came down, smashing perhaps half a mile away from the smoking crater in which lay the mangled wreckage of the Terran ship. The disabled scout pilot must have played a last desperate game, making of his ship bait for a trap. The Terran had taken one Throg with him. Shan rubbed again at his eyes, just barely able to catch a glimpse of the second ship flashing away westward. Perhaps it was only his impaired sight, but it appeared to him that the Throg followed an erratic path, either as if the pilot feared to be caught by a second shot, or because that ship had also suffered some injury. Acid smoke wreathed up from the valley, making Shan retch and cough. There could be no survivor from the Terran scout, and he did not believe that any Throg had lived to crawl free of the crumpled plate. But there would be other beetles swarming here soon. They would not dare to leave the scene unsearched. He wondered about that scout. Had the pilot been aiming for the survey camp, the absence of any rider beam from there warning him off so that he made the detour which brought him here? Or had the Throgs tried to blast the Terran ship in the upper atmosphere, crippling it, making this a forced landing? But at least this battle had cost the Throgs, settling a small portion of the Terran debt for the lost camp. The length of time between Shan's sighting of the grounded ship and the attack by the Throgs had been so short that he had not really developed any strong hope of rescue to be destroyed by the end of the crippled ship. On the other hand, seeing the Throgs take a beating had exploded his subconscious acceptance of their superiority. He might not have even the resources of a damaged scout at his command, but he did have Taggy, Togi, and his own brain, since he was fated to permanent exile on Warlock. There might just be some way to make the Beatles pay for that. He licked his lips. Real action against the aliens would take a lot of planning. Shan would have to know more about what made a Throg, more than all the wild stories he had heard over the years. There had to be some way a Terran could move effectively against a beetle head. And he had a lot of time, maybe the rest of his life, to work out a few answers. That Throg ship lying wrecked at the foot of the cliff. Perhaps he could do a little investigating before any rescue squad arrived. Shan decided such a move was worth the try and whistled to the Wolverines. Please join me next time for another exciting chapter of Storm Over Warlock by Andre Norton here on Astounding Stories of Space and Time. Until then, watch the skies.